ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming. We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Artificial intelligence and gender bias. Can AI reveal the assumptions judges make? Help lawyers and litigants to identify appeal arguments? Assist organisations and courts to improve their work? Or even help audit legislation?
Sometimes people just want a headline story. Does Australia perform better in this area of law than the Philippines, for example? Among the 10 pieces of legislation on gender-based violence, which is the best performing? And the machine learning algorithm helps us highlight those good performers.
Before we get to that, let's start with a study that used machine learning algorithms to analyse how judges think and the assumptions that may underpin some of their decisions.
When you're looking at the way in which male and female judges discuss particular types of cases, there are differences between the ways in which they discuss particular topics in the context of family law, and there are differences in terms of the types of topics that are associated with male and female parties in family law cases involving children.
That's Associate Professor Mira Sanrock from the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law and Justice and its Gender Equality Hub. She's lead author of a study using artificial intelligence which found gender bias in the language used by some family court judges. The research used large language models to analyse thousands of court decisions. Mira, what legal decisions were examined as part of your study?
So we were using a large set of family law decisions over a 20-year period up until 2021. Ultimately, we had about 2,700 decisions encompassing over 23,000 paragraphs and over 95,000 sentences. And then we analysed which topics are being discussed in those cases, whether particular topics were more likely to be associated with mothers or fathers, and whether there was any differences in terms of the way that male and female judges discussed those topics.
So, Mira, what did you find?
What we found were some patterns which certainly align with what you might consider to be sort of gendered assumptions. So some mother topics, for example, so topics more likely to be associated with the mother, tended to align with things like childcare, child rearing, decision making and so forth. So you might say that mothers are being discussed more when the topic involves the expectation that mothers are primarily the ones involved or responsible for the care of the child. Conversely, risk assessments tended to be more associated with fathers. Now, that might reflect both reality in terms of questions about when risk is raised, but it might also raise some questions about assumptions about who is more likely to pose a risk to the child.
So there seemed to be more focus or discussion of the capacity of mothers as caregivers. What about the fathers? Was there more discussion about their capacity to provide financially?
Yeah, so initially that certainly was the case, that finance topics and liability for child support were more likely to be associated with fathers, but that was decreasing over time. We also found that there was perhaps a higher level of discussion around fathers when we were thinking about time, capacity or engagement. And there does seem to have been some emphasis in the decisions on the way in which the father is engaging with the child. When we looked at some examples, we also found some interesting issues in relation to capacity, which was that the father's capacity to care for the child in the future was often associated with the fact that the father had repartnered with a competent new partner who was able to take on some of those tasks of child rearing. So we identified that time and behaviour of the father was a topic that was associated with them. When we looked at some examples, we saw some examples where the judges tended to align the capacity of the father with the capacity of the new partner, and that the father got the benefit of that new partnering.
And maybe there weren't sort of analogous discussions about mothers and...
That didn't seem to come up as a frequency of words or topics associated with the mother, no.
So you'd say these ideas about the capacity as caregivers and as financial providers, the study indicates a sort of a gendered position, in some cases by some judges. Were there differences in the language used by male and female judges?
Yeah, so we did also find that there were certain topics that were more likely to be associated with female judges. So female judges were more likely to discuss topics relating to co-parenting, organisation and logistics. They were also more likely to discuss risk and questions about risk to the child and concerns about future, I guess, sort of risks of harm in that regard.
What findings or conclusions did the study come to around the way some judges discuss violence, or the way maybe male and female judges discuss violence?
So that was a slightly different part of the study. So that wasn't part of the study that we were using AI for. It was one where we were using some more linguistic techniques. So we were working also with linguists on this project. So they used sort of corpus linguistic techniques and some other ways of thinking about language there. And so we were looking at a smaller subset. But what we found there was patterns, again, that very much replicate what other earlier feminist work has uncovered when looking at smaller sets of cases, which is that often when talking about allegations of violence or talking about family violence in the context of parenting or in the context of custody disputes, that the judges tended to talk about the violence as situational rather than created by a particular person. And so the linguistic features of that are that you don't talk about who has perpetrated the violence, you simply talk about violence has happened. You don't talk about who is responsible for violence, you talk about it as something that has simply emerged from the relationship. And the significance of that is that the expectation is that once the relationship has separated, that violence will disappear. So it tends to minimise the risks of violence in the future.
And how big a difference was there between male and female judges with regards to these sorts of issues?
We don't have the data in terms of the differences between the male and female judges on the violence data set. It's too small for that. But what we do certainly had was that there was a statistically significant difference between the way that female judges tended to think about or talk about future risk versus male judges.
And did the way that male or female judges use language translate or indicate a certain outcome in a case? In other words, did certain attitudes or word choices translate into decisions more favourable for male and female litigants?
Yeah. So unfortunately, that's not something we're able to identify from this data set. And that's partly because the question of what is an outcome that is more or less favourable is incredibly difficult to extract from a judgment in any sort of large scale way. These are very complex decisions. The outcomes can be quite sort of finely grained. And so it's not really possible from this set to be able to say that it's translating into outcomes specifically. What we can say, though, is that if you think about the way in which our common law legal system works, is that the language that judges use really matters, because our system is text-based, it's precedence-based. Decisions that are made in one case will have influence in other cases, particularly if they're more sort of senior courts. And so it's certainly plausible to infer that if gendered expectations, and in particular, if expectations around sort of appropriate gender performance are not being met, that there are ways in which this language could translate into differential types of outcomes.
Have there been other studies analysing the text of large numbers of court decisions or court transcripts?
There have been different studies done in different kinds of contexts. So not all of them have been looking at the same types of things that we have. But certainly, I mean, there have been studies that have looked at things like patterns of interruptions during court hearings. So a study that was done in 2017 and then returned to in 2023 was looking at interruptions in the Supreme Court in the US to see, analysing transcripts to see whether male or female judges were interrupted more or less, and it demonstrated sort of clear gender disparities between the way in which female judges were interrupted as compared to male judges.
By male judges on the bench or by male advocates?
Well, both, actually, interestingly. So female judges were more likely to be interrupted both by their male peers and also by male advocates. The later analysis indicated that some of those patterns were shifting, but that male judges still seemed to interrupt their female colleagues more often, and that there was some work also done in Australia looking at the High Court cases in 2015 to 2017 that also identified some similar patterns in the High Court here, that female judges were more likely to be interrupted compared to male judges.
Okay, so there's an organisation in the UK called Her Ethical AI, and I've been speaking with the CEO. What's your understanding of the work they've been doing, and how is it different from the focus of your work?
Yeah, so that's really interesting work, and I think is an example of a really sort of productive use of the capacities of AI systems. They focused on a very particular sort of known phenomenon, I guess, which is that when you're looking at allegations of domestic violence or family violence that are being brought by women, that a pattern that has been identified by feminist scholars in the past is that there is a tendency towards victim blaming. And so we saw that as well in some of our work when we were looking at the way in which violence within the family was discussed in the smaller subset of cases, where you might have a judge talking about the unreasonable behaviour of the mother, or you might have the judge talking about the way in which the violence kind of emerges from the relationship. So Her Ethical AI are interested in whether it's possible to uncover examples of this kind of victim-blaming language across a range of kind of stages in the criminal justice process. So they're interested in whether you can use these systems to identify gendered sort of victim-blaming language in police reports, and then whether that can then sort of flow through to the way in which advocates maybe present their arguments and the way in which judges might then resolve or kind of determine that. So as I understand it, they've developed a system which identifies these sort of features of victim-blaming language at different levels. And the idea of that, I think, is that, you know, for example, if a police officer is writing up a report, perhaps they could audit their report to see if they are perhaps unconsciously replicating some of these biases, which will then sort of flow through into other stages. Similarly, maybe judges could use it to review their work and identify whether they are using some of these tropes or ideas, perhaps unconsciously. So I think that's a really interesting potential use for that.
And my understanding is it's also a tool that lawyers can use who are representing clients. So they could, say, then use that large language model and feed, say, a family court decision into the large language model. And if it identifies language, that could be used as the basis for an appeal or an application to change the judge or even make a complaint against the judge. Is that your understanding?
I believe so, yes. So I think certainly one of the things that you could use it would be to sort of flag or prompt arguments along that line. And yes, I think at a perhaps more extreme level, you might be able to use it as evidence that perhaps a particular judge was exhibiting these types of language behaviours more than others, and that perhaps that was an indication of some sort of bias. That would be a pretty risky sort of strategy, I think, a lawyer, but it would certainly assist to sort of flag some of those issues.
Assist the lawyers in finding language, but then they'd have to turn their minds to it and their legal skills to see whether or not there is actually something substantial there.
Substantial, yeah. And I think, I mean, Her Ethical AI would say this themselves, is that, you know, what you certainly can't do with these systems is just kind of accept any results at face value. You need to always be checking them, validating them. And if you were to be using in the context of casework, then absolutely you would need to be checking that independently. And that's the same with, you know, to come back to your question about sort of generative AI or bias within AI systems more generally. I mean, that's a real challenge for the legal profession now overall, is that these tools may have great benefit, but the need for human oversight and for checking and for sort of validation of what's coming out of the systems, whether it's generative AI, whether it's a system that is trying to identify problems within a particular decision, you always need to have that sort of human oversight to say, well, what's actually going on here? Do we really feel that this is an appropriate finding?
University of New South Wales Associate Professor Meera Sanrock, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks so much, Damien.
Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National and available anytime on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. As I was just discussing with Meera, there's a UK-based startup called Her Ethical AI, which commenced operation in December. The CEO is Dr. Tamara Polena. She's a visiting academic in the Department of Computer Science and Technology at Cambridge University. Her team has developed an AI-based app, still in its experimental stages, that they hope could be used as a self-audit tool by police, the courts and counsellors who deal with traumatised people, and potentially to analyse court decisions for language that may suggest unfair treatment.
We allow people to upload text. It could be plain text, it can be a PDF document. It doesn't always have to be in a court appeal or a court document necessarily, but it helps if it's in a regulated domain, because victim blaming as a something that can traumatise people makes more sense in a regulated domain. And so what it does is it goes through basically line by line, sentence by sentence, looking how that sentence fits into the context of the entire document and whether it constitutes potentially some sort of victim blaming. It then highlights that sentence and explains why, in the context of the document, it thinks that it's victim blaming. So it allows people to quickly review long documents through highlights and sticky notes, seeing where and why something might potentially be victim blaming, then can be used to form a basis of an appeal if necessary.
And do you have a sense of who's using the app? Are they legal practitioners or are they self-represented litigants?
Mainly it's been self-represented litigants until now. Yeah, it's people who have experienced this firsthand and various sort of cases and various sort of situations, putting letters and court documents that they have through. And at the moment, mainly justifying their feelings, although a few people are looking to use it as basis of their appeal. And one person, I think, has actually made it known in court that they have looked at the previous parts of their case.
Computer scientist Dr. Tamara Polena, CEO of UK-based startup Her Ethical AI, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you very much.
So far, we've been speaking about using AI to identify possible gender bias or victim blaming in family law litigation. But AI is also being used to analyse legislation to measure how well a law addresses gender inequality. Professor of Law at the University of Technology, Sydney, Ramona Vijayarasa, is the creator of the Gender Legislative Index, known as GLI. Hi, Ramona. You say that a gender-neutral law isn't necessarily gender responsive. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we need to remember that in society, one law is governed for everyone. One law is written for everyone. And we have to ask ourselves, is it possible for one law to suit everyone in society? And so part of the process requires us to think, how will a diversity of women experience legislation? Are there specific needs and rights written into the law? And often our legal systems have tended towards a very male-centric lens, and we've excused legislation for ignoring gender by saying, oh, this is a neutral matter and we don't really need to think about neutral. Workplace safety, for example, is a common one that's treated as a gender-neutral subject matter. But gender-neutral very quickly becomes gender-blind if it fails to acknowledge there are women-specific experiences, such as sexual harassment, that need to be addressed. And if the law fails to enable women to use the law, it can quickly become regressive.
So laws that don't mention gender can still work against women and need to be evaluated for their impact on women. So how does the Gender Legislative Index work? What is it and how does it work?
So the Gender Legislative Index is a tool I created at the University of Technology, Sydney, with a team of software engineers called Rapido Social Impact. And we basically use it to assess domestic laws with their compatibility with women's rights. We've so far looked at laws from across 6 countries, and this year we'll be scaling up and hope to reach 25 countries across really diverse domains, for example, family law or labour law, tax legislation, public procurement. And the reason why we look at such a diversity of laws is because of the importance of bringing a gender perspective to all legislation. Obviously, everything is going to affect women and men and non-binary people in society differently, so every law needs a gender perspective. We bring a lot of human evaluators together, so there is a lot of manual work, and we read the provisions of the law and we make an assessment against certain benchmarks. But what we end up with is a lot of data, and this is where AI or machine learning is really helpful. The Gender Legislative Index uses a machine learning algorithm. It's trained on a subset of the data. And so it will take all the responses from the many evaluators and give a final headline story. So an individual evaluator might give 42 responses when evaluating a single law, and multiply that by 3. If you have 3 evaluators looking at a law, that's a lot of data. And sometimes people just want a headline story. Does Australia perform better in this area of law than the Philippines, for example? Among the 10 pieces of legislation on gender-based violence, which is the best performing? And the machine learning algorithm helps us highlight those good performers.
As I understand it, over 142 pieces of legislation across 6 countries have been evaluated in this way. Can you give me some examples of how the Gender Legislative Index has been used? I understand it's been quite important in places like Tasmania.
That's right. And it's really interesting because people feel very differently about machine learning. Some are very reticent. They're worried about its impact on jobs or the risk of lending institutions or health providers using AI in ways that will impact people's lives. And they're really legitimate concerns. But other people find it really exciting. And I think in reality, the timing of when the Gender Legislative Index has been created has meant the machine learning brings a little bit of confidence and excitement in a context where I think people are looking for new ways to innovate to actually close gender inequality gaps. And so the Gender Legislative Index was picked up by an independent Member of Parliament, Ruth Forrest, in Tasmania, who was really excited about the methodology and put forward a motion that was successful before the Tasmanian Legislative Council to create an audit committee in Parliament to do exactly what I'm talking about, audit legislation for its gendered impacts before it's passed. So there's a lot of interest. In the Australian context, many people say to me, surely we don't have discrimination in law in Australia. That exists in other countries. And there are countries with really overt discrimination in legislation, countries that require a male guarantor before a woman can get a bank loan, or countries like Vietnam that have forced retirement for women at an earlier age than men. But in countries like Australia, there is discrimination, but it's often hidden. So it needs a more careful exploration to find these examples. So for instance, for many years, Australia had workplace safety laws that failed to meet international standards because they ignored sexual harassment and violence in the workplace. They understood workplace safety, both physical and psychological, in really narrow terms. Will there be a spillage on the factory floor that someone's responsibility? And that's been picked up by the Gender Legislative Index, and those sorts of laws have changed in recent years. Another law evaluated by the Gender Legislative Index was Australia's paid maternity leave law from 2010. When we introduced paid maternity leave, surprisingly late compared to many wealthy countries like Australia, we framed and named mothers as primary carers. And while the law has reformed since, it's very hard to challenge that idea that women are naturally the primary carers in this effort to move towards more equal sharing of care among parents. To offer another example, it took Australia until 2022 to introduce 10 days of paid leave for victims of violence. And yet the Gender Legislative Index shows us that the Philippines got there first, all the way back in 2004. So by evaluating legislation, not only can we pull out examples of gender blindness in legislation, but we can also pull out the best performers so that legislators don't have to reinvent the books or sit around and wait and miss examples of legislation that could help address gender inequality, which is a problem still today in every country in the world.
And AI and algorithms, they're important. This work couldn't really be done to the same scale without them.
That's right. You know, I think it's an area where we need to be cautious. People have naturally started asking me, can AI write legislation? And I think what the answer has to be is we don't want to use AI for the sake of it. We must ask ourselves, in what ways will AI improve upon what we are doing? I don't think we're at the stage where we could use machine learning or a large language model to evaluate legislation without human intervention and really identify the best practices. You could look for certain terms, access to remedies, access to services, free and affordable. And that can you can therefore use machine learning to help comb through large volumes of legislation, but human intervention is still needed. And so at the end of the day, if we're using AI to start to unpack where is good legislation for women and for a diversity of women, we need to think about how are we using the AI to do what we're doing already better.
And of course, Ramona, you work at the legislative level, but other lawyers are looking at analysing decisions and transcripts and other legal documents for highlighting legal issues such as equality, gender equality. Do you think that's also useful work?
I think Mera's work is excellent. I think it's really promising that we can comb through judgments in ways that might be faster and more effective and efficient than if we were manually doing this work. Again, the question comes back to, in what ways will AI improve the work that gender equality scholars and gender equality advocates are doing? And then at the other end, well, what can we do with that information? We still need to be training judges on how they're responding to victims and survivors in court cases or to mothers and fathers in family law. We still need to train legislators to think differently when writing legislation. Who is going to be affected by this law? Will this law genuinely improve women's lives? It's still legislators in Parliament who are writing and passing legislation. So all of that work is still there. We just have access to a tool that can potentially enable us to get more information to the people who need it to do better the work on addressing gender inequality.
And do you see it as also being potentially useful for self-represented litigants or for legal practitioners in terms of analysing transcripts that are available and affordable or also judgments and decisions?
Well, without pressing on the point too much, again, I think it comes back to this question of will AI enable us to do what we're already doing better? I'm always nervous with self-represented litigants. There's so much information available. And you have to ask the question, will someone in need of legal support have the ability to query the AI's decision or the information being provided to them in ways that aren't putting them in a detrimental position? Are they giving the AI information about their own lives, for example, a situation of domestic violence that might put them at risk if the chatbot or the machine learning tool isn't protecting their confidentiality? So there's lots of considerations for this work to be done well. Of course, legal aid is very difficult to come by. Some people live in remote and rural legal communities and might not have access to a local lawyer. Sometimes people just want to be heard, and by being able to raise their case with an AI, they might feel some sort of sense of justice being served. There are many advantages of these tools. We just need to be also conscious of the risks around confidentiality, quality legal services, and ensuring that people have the right to inform decision making when they're using these tools to get legal advice.
Mm. University of Technology Sydney law professor Ramona Vijayarasa, the creator of the Gender Legislative Index. A very interesting conversation. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Damien.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and to audio producer this week, Tim Simons. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.